politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Adam!
Bo?
Travis?
Bo, I know you're an animal lover, specifically a dog lover, and I was wondering if you'd heard about the puppy scam.
I shudder to think. No, I have not. What is it?
It's something where during COVID, during the first part of the COVID lockdown, everyone was adopting dogs.
Yeah.
I know at least like five or six people who just got a dog just because they're trapped inside, nothing else to do. So apparently there are these scam rings where they will get the cutest little picture of a puppy with like sad basset hound eyes and scam people into adopting them and then just pretty much running off with their money.
It's a multi-million dollar crime that leaves heartbreak in its wake, and those who track it say it is run by organized gangs.
We're talking about puppy scams tonight. Consumer investigators.
Well, I mean, it's okay, Adam. You're a good boy. First thing I thought was Toby the Rabbit. Do you remember Toby the Rabbit? Anybody?
No.
Adam?
I remember Harvey the Invisible Rabbit.
No, Harvey's different. So no, Toby was a cute little bunny, and there was a photograph of him on a frying pan. And the caption said, if we don't make $10,000 by the end of the day, we're going to eat Toby.
Ooh.
And people sent the money. You don't remember this, Travis?
I think you talked about it in another episode, but I don't remember the actual bunny yet.
An empty crate, unfilled food bowls, and puppy toys waiting to be played with, all of it purchased in anticipation of Millie, a Havanese puppy who warmed the hearts of the Mac family.
So no, I don't know about this, but that is exactly the sort of thing that makes me want to get a really cool suit and swear more than I even already do and become the second coming of Deadpool and get the bad guys.
Well, if it's any consolation, it does sound like Google is suing the main guy behind it.
Well, what, I mean, how does it even work? Was there just one dude who was pinky to the lips stealing puppy money?
Yeah, he was apparently soliciting specifically basset hounds, and the way to pay him was, wait for it, gift cards.
Oh, shut
up. He wanted $700 worth of gift cards. So you would think that would be kind of the first red flag there, because I've never once seen anyone buy a puppy with Apple gift cards, but there you have it.
And if we're talking about basset hounds, I mean, I'm all ears.
Oh, well, I mean, and Adam actually does. I didn't know this was wrong, but Adam pays me in gift cards.
Yes, I certainly do, don't I?
Yes, yes. So,
no wonder you don't get a W-2 or a 1099. But I figured that out now.
But it seems kind of nuts to me. Like, you get somebody's like, you know, Adam.
Bo?
I have the water skiing boat, I'm sure that's not what you call it. You can tell that I don't water ski, that you've been looking for, just like old Noah, our previous guest. And you can have it. You just need to give me $20,000 in Amazon gift cards. I mean, really?
Well, one of the main things, too, is that they this one scammer in particular went after elderly people who were sequestered during COVID.
Oh, so, gosh. Yeah. Counterfeit dogs. What will they think of next?
Counterfeit credit cards?
Ah. Which brings us to our episode today. Although they weren't really they weren't counterfeit dogs, were they?
But you have to love the picture of a duck with cardboard puppy ears taped to its head.
Oh, that was you who sent me that.
Oop.
Gotcha. Welcome to What the Hack with Adam Levin, a show about hackers, scammers, and the people they go after. I'm Bo, Cyber Skimmer.
I'm Adam, a.k.a. Kenneth Bo's Bear.
How did you know what I named my bear?
Because you told me what you named your bear.
Oh, Kenny.
And I'm Travis, Cyber Donkey.
Donkey! And today we're talking with a former Secret Service agent who took down a transnational counterfeit credit card ring. The man, the myth, the legend, Brian Ebert.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Hey,
So here's the deal. I use Yahoo Finance. I use it to make money because it works. Not just because they're a sponsor of the show. Heck, I've been using them for years before they ever called to become a sponsor. I do a lot of investing, and I need to make split-second financial decisions, and that's where Yahoo Finance comes in. I trade stocks, and I trade options, and you can't trade them in a vacuum. You gotta know what's going on. Yahoo Finance gives you the opportunity to look at the whole picture. I mean, breaking news, editorial perspectives, analyst ratings, independent research, customizable charts. I love the customizable charts. They have it all. At Yahoo Finance, I'm part of a community of over 90 million users. You heard me. 90 million folks use Yahoo Finance because they're helping you on your way to financial success. Visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. That's yahoofinance.com, yahoofinance.com.
This spring, get out there, enjoy the weather, and recapture the magic of riding a bike with Electric e-bike.
With an amazing variety of models built for riders of all abilities, it's never been easier to fall in love with riding again. Plus, every electric e-bike ships free and only requires quick, toolless assembly.
This is my first ever e-bike, and the experience has just been great. I was a little bit intimidated at first because I hadn't gone biking in a while, but the 500-watt motor that the electric e-bike comes with really gives you a nice little boost, especially if you're trying to go uphill or pick up some speed.
Data shows that e-bike riders take their bike out more often. That means you get more exercise, more exploration, and wait for it, fresh air.
And riding an e-bike isn't like, it's not cheating. It's just making it possible for you to be out there longer on each ride. And speaking of things going a little slower, you can finance electric e-bike for as little as $49 a month.
Get into spring with Electric e-bikes, the number one selling e-bikes in the nation. Get your adventure started at electricebikes.com. And please mention that What the Heck with Adam Levin sent you in the post-checkout survey.
That's electricebikes.com. It is good to see you, and it's nice that we have, you know, someone who looks respectable on this show. Welcome. It's so great to see you.
Fantastic to be here.
I missed you. For our folks in our audience to know, Brian and I had the opportunity to work together for a couple of years. I have nothing but admiration for Brian. Brian is one of those guys that when you think about superstars, Brian is a superstar.
Okay, now hold it, Adam.
Yeah.
I had no idea that you were in the Secret Service.
You didn't know that? You understand that's why it's called secret.
I think Travis probably has some questions here because, you know, I don't buy it. I don't think you were in the Secret Service.
Yeah, I'd have to say I'm skeptical on that note. But so, Brian, pleasure to meet you. What did you do for the Secret Service?
So I was with the Secret Service for 30 years, hard to believe.
Wow.
I retired last year. The role I retired from, I was the chief of staff of the agency. And a couple of roles I had before that, I was the deputy assistant director for protective operations, helping to lead our global protective mission. And prior to that, I was the special agent in charge of our Washington field office, which covers Washington, D.C. and parts of Northern Virginia and Southern Maryland.
Wow. How did you actually land that gig or those gigs?
Just spent a career in the Secret Service. And, you know, we have two missions in the Secret Service to investigate financial crimes and to protect our elected leaders. So it's surprising how often the two different parts of our mission mutually support each other. Mm. So throughout our careers, we sort of bounce around in different assignments on both sides of that mission area. And you become a better and better investigator and stronger at working protective operations. So I just had some great opportunities to work some really fun, diverse assignments around the world. So it was a fantastic career.
As the head of protective details, you had to have protected some like really cool people, right?
Yes. Fortunately, can't go into a lot of details, but I can certainly talk about who I protect, was involved in protecting. So we protect the president and vice president and their families.
Right.
Everybody knows that. During campaign season, we protect the the candidates, when they reach a certain threshold, is decided by a panel up in Congress that decides. So we protect the most of the major candidates as well. And then what a lot of people, we protect the former presidents, but what a lot of people don't know is we protect all the foreign visiting heads of state. So the presidents, prime ministers, kings, queens, that when they're on U.S. soil, Secret Service is responsible for protecting them as well.
All right. So without revealing too much information, who was, in your estimation, in all the years that you were involved doing your work with the Secret Service, who was the most interesting foreign dignitary that you were in charge of the protective detail for?
Wow, there was so many, and I did a few years up in our New York office, and a lot of these world leaders would come in for the United Nations, so we had a lot of them. You know, the president of Tuvalu, which is a small island, a small island in the Pacific, and smaller than Manhattan, and with the much smaller population. That was really interesting, because they adhered to a lot of the customs and cultures from their small island country, and they hadn't spent a lot of time in the United States or in big cities. So I was a young agent when I was on that detail, back when I was assigned to our Los Angeles field office, and we actually went to Disneyland in California, and took the leader there with his small little entourage. His chief of staff was his brother-in-law. And we went and did Disneyland and did all the rides. And Disneyland itself had a bigger population than his country and was not physically much smaller than his country. So that was probably the most interesting experience I had, because at the same time, as small as the country is, and as differently cultural, he's one of the, 160 some world leaders, that are represented at the United Nations. So it was interesting to spend time with him.
And I have to ask, so did you take him on the It's a Small World ride?
We did the It's a Small World ride, and we did a number of rides, and I got to know him a little bit, and I pointed out Space Mountain, and I said, sir, are you interested in doing Space Mountain? The other agents on this protective assignment were senior agents that have been around a long time, and I was the new kid, and so I was, and I, was a little bit closer to spending time in amusement parks than the senior agents were. So I was sort of given the task of communicating with him about what he wanted to do, and I have to say, I pushed him towards Space Mountain, and he was very concerned about going on it in first, that it was a scary roller coaster. But I explained that there was a planet that looked like a giant chocolate chip cookie. The president really liked his chocolate chip cookies. And so he eventually agreed to go on the roller coaster. That his brother-in-law, the chief of staff, was not at all happy about it, but he turned a little bit green on it. But the man and I rode in the front seat, and I got him to put his arms up, and
American tradition.
Did you turn a little green in the front seat, or were you okay?
Did he get Mickey ears? Is the question I have.
He did not. The only time I saw him, he was a very humble man, a very nice man. The only time I saw him assert his privilege a little bit, as he turned to the VIP host that was kind of taking us through. After the roller coaster came back, he wasn't quick to get out of the car when it came back, and the guardrail came up, and he said, "We will ride your Space Mountain again." And so we went and did a second round
of
riding.
Nice. So it was fun. What was like your most Jason Bourne moment?
I need to know this too. You're a Secret Service guy. Like, you must be able to like do backflips while you're shooting people upside down, right?
The younger agents are got them involved with more of the acrobatics. Okay. No, you know, I mean, the job is really, it's a very, very interesting job, but it's all about relationships with other law enforcement partners and with the intelligence community and international partners, and building those relationships and getting everybody on the same page is what it's all about. Certainly the most exciting moments I had were probably more on our investigative mission back, and I came up on the West Coast. So working fraud cases and, you know, working informants and involved in undercover deals, and you know, doing surveillances on the bad guys and staking them out, and you know, when you get the search warrant, you know, doing entries into the houses and locking up the bad guys, all that. There was some, there was a couple car chases, a couple of folks that didn't want to be arrested that either ran or wanted to fight a little bit. So plenty of excitement, but mostly it's about just, you know, nose to the grindstone, doing the investigations, building the relationships, and you know, getting the mission done.
So the Secret Service started actually in the on the financial side as tracking down counterfeiters and stuff like that. Am I right, or how did it begin?
You're exactly right. We came into existence in 1865. President Lincoln actually commissioned us to investigate counterfeit currency during the Civil War. At that time, it was estimated over a third of all the currency in population was actually counterfeit. But yeah, we work counterfeit currency investigations, which we still work to this day. And it kind of morphed into other types of fraud. It wasn't until 1901, when President McKinley was assassinated, that we actually started our protective mission started. And both our investigative mission has and our protective mission, which we really consider one mission, like two different parts of our mission, have really grown exponentially on both sides. And protecting people grew into protecting places as well as events, certain events that are designated. So we protect those events as well. And on the investigative side, we've sort of grown to a point where we, you know, our job is to help keep the financial infrastructure of the country safe. And so we really mostly now, we still work counterfeit currency and more traditional frauds, but the majority of what we do is we investigate cyber enabled fraud cases. And so that's really the backbone of our investigative mission. And we're able to use what we learn on both sides of our mission to support the other. And that's why it makes sense to have these two parts of the mission, which seem to be unrelated at first, but it really makes sense for one agency to be involved with both because they mutually support each other so well.
And you're also working on things like cryptocurrency scams too, right? Wouldn't that be part of the...
Absolutely. I mean, right now, I know the agency, I've been out for a few months, but I know the agency is very focused on investigating and seizing digital assets from cyber criminal actors and educating the public also about how to recognize the illegal use of digital assets, you know, like Bitcoin and other digital currencies that the bad guys are using to launder or cash out stolen funds from ransomware attacks or other types of digital scams, like exploiting online dating and professional networking sites, social media scams, in any type of cyber-enabled financial crimes. The Secret Service actually has a new public-facing cyber currency awareness site to educate the community and to provide a forum for reporting potentially legal activity.
I just got back from France, and there was a lot of stuff I couldn't stream because I was in the wrong region. But using NordVPN, I was able to stream everything.
I use NordVPN too, but it's more to protect my private data, like bank details, passwords, and online identity. There are a million trackers online that are just sort of watching you, and NordVPN is a great way to get around those.
NordVPN can switch your virtual location, allowing you to save money by purchasing flights, hotels, subscriptions from other countries at a cheaper price.
If you're traveling and you're using public Wi-Fi, NordVPN can protect you wherever you are.
It's not just that. NordVPN also comes with threat protection, which helps protect you from viruses, malware, and phishing sites.
NordVPN is the fastest VPN in the world, and it'll only set you back the price of a cup of coffee a month.
To get the best discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/WTHack.
And hey, there's no risk. It's a 30-day money-back guarantee.
Check the link in the podcast description.
When you talk about counterfeiting, right, so there's obviously counterfeiting currency, but you also talked about another kind of counterfeiting program. And that had to do with credit card counterfeiting, right?
Absolutely. We got involved with credit cards soon after they started to be used. And, you know, the bad guys are always adapting and evolving, so we have to be as well. And they were quickly learning how to commit fraud with either stolen credit cards or stolen credit card numbers that could be encoded onto the magnetic strip of counterfeit credit cards and embossed onto the front of the card, and then often using a counterfeit IDs to in support with these counterfeit credit cards, again, containing stolen credit card number account information to purchase high dollar items. So that's certainly been an issue for a long time.
So when did this start though? I mean, is this like I think of like the Silk Road black market of yesteryear, and it predated that. No, did scams start with credit cards? I mean, Adam would know the answer to this too, like from day one or soon after.
They absolutely did. I mean, long before the Silk Road.
What year are we talking about?
We're talking around 2006.
Okay. Wow.
So that was like before there were transaction alerts for credit cards. That was before we had credit cards with chips in them. Where would they get the stock that they would use for the fake credit cards?
The group that we were investigating did not make the counterfeit cards themselves. They purchased those in bulk for like sleeves of 500 from overseas. So they would come, they would have a bank on them. It might be Citibank, it might be any number of different banks on them. And the front would be blank with nothing, no numbers or name embossed into the plastic. And the magnetic strip, it would be a real magnetic strip, but it would be empty of information.
So you're mentioning that they were getting these cards from overseas. Was there one specific hub or one country that was more prone to have these, or was it just like a truly worldwide operation?
These particular cards were being purchased in Hong Kong. The bad guys were very smart. They would decentralize the different parts of this scam. The first part was that they would enlist servers in restaurants to use small handheld devices that were skimming devices. And so when customers would pay for their meal with a credit card, on the way to the stand to run the card, they would slide it through the device, the skimming device, which would capture the information.
So in other words, Bo would go into a restaurant, he would finish dinner, he would hand his credit card to a waiter. The waiter would go into the back room, because those were the days when they would take your credit card and go in the back as opposed to bringing a little device for you to stick your card in. They'd go in the back, they would do the normal credit card charge, but they would make a copy for themselves while they were at it.
That's exactly correct.
And what is it, a skimming device? Like, what does it actually do? How does it work?
It's just a portable version of like a point of sale terminal, except all it does, like that you use at any merchant, that when you put your card in, it reads the information. But this skimming device is smaller, and all it does is capture the digital information that's on the magnetic strip. So it will be the name of the cardholder, and it will be the account number and perhaps some other information. Now, this was before other security features that now exist on credit cards before
like
they
EMV
have been implemented.
Chip or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
correct. It was before, just when chips were coming out and the CVV codes weren't being used regularly yet. So it was before some of the, that's these sort of scams is why some of these security features were added by the banks for sure.
2000, I would say one, maybe right at the right 2000 in Chinatown. I used to work in Chinatown. I purchased.
We won't ask Bo what he did in Chinatown.
I was a book publisher. And so I was.
That's what they all say when they work in China. No, I'm a book publisher.
They all say it. It's weird. Walk down the street, you throw a rock and you got a book publisher. But at any rate, I was down there and I bought a pair of sneakers at this shop on Canal Street. And a few days later, my credit card had $5,000 worth of gold charged on it. Gold jewelry that was purchased on the West Coast. And that was in 2000. But it sounds a bit like what you're talking about. Is it possible that I was skimmed way back then, or did these skimming devices not exist back then?
It absolutely existed for sure back into the 90s. But there are also all sorts of other ways for criminals to steal the information. One of the first cases that I was involved with, I wasn't the case agent on it, but I helped out with it as a real junior agent. So this was like 1992. We called it the Fredericks of Hollywood case because there were folks that served as operators that you could call in to Fredericks of Hollywood to buy lingerie or whatever tickle your fancy from that company, and they were capturing all the credit card numbers from customers that were buying the from Fredericks of Hollywood. And sell them in bulk to other bad guys who would again encode and emboss them onto counterfeit cards, and use them to buy to do cash advances or to do high dollar purchases for items that they could turn around and fence. It's been going on a long time.
So the guys who were doing the skimming in these restaurants, the waiters, were they getting a piece of the action? By the way, in those days,
generally they were getting paid a flat rate, which would be pretty low, like $25 a number that they skimmed, because that card might have $5,000 worth of credit, or it might have, you know, $50 worth of credit.
And is this anyone, or is it, or did they pick like a specific, like, did they just go to like Italian restaurants? I cannot believe they said Italian restaurants. Did they go to, you know, German American restaurants or McDonald's, or where kind of places were they
or
going?
Or higher end Good restaurants, save. You know,
IHOP.
I can say that I've seen these sort of skimming operations work out at many different types of restaurants.
Okay, but they're going after waiters, and they're just saying, you know, if you every time you do it, we'll give you a certain amount of money.
So the device is designed to take multiple. Every time you slide it, it like adds another line of data. So you slide somebody's cart, it grabs the data off that, which might take three lines, and then you go and grab the next card for somebody paying their bill, and you put it in, and it's the next three lines. So
if you caught one of them, they couldn't help you catch the other guys. It was decentralized.
Not talking about this particular case, but often when you caught the skimmers, they only knew one person, and they knew him by the first name, and it was just like a way for them to make extra money. Or a lot of times the waiters would maybe have gambling debts. And this was a way to pay off the debt. Like, hey, you owe Jimmy $5,000. You know, you get us 100 numbers, and your slate will be clean. Like, there was also a decent amount of that incentive. Or sometimes it was just straight money.
Bo made me get him 200 credit cards. You know, so I thought that was a little unfair. But are there ways that consumers can protect themselves from being victimized by a skimmer?
Well, the good news about this sort of scam is that with all the new security features that we're not seeing as much of this, we are still seeing it at, there's fake ATM machines. We're seeing it at gas stations where they put up a fake card reader that's really just capturing all that information. I mean, the advice that I'd give is to just pay attention. And, you know, in terms of ATMs, I would make sure it's in a reputable area at, you know, preferably at a bank, but just pay attention and use your common sense and be thoughtful about where you use your cards. The other thing is most of the victims of these scams, where their cards are number, where their number information is, account information is stolen one way or the other, they don't know a crime's been committed until they get their bill. And back then, it wasn't normal that people could go online and check their credit card account information regularly. So if people can check their bank accounts and their credit accounts on a regular basis, they're more likely to see that that fraud activity and be able to shut it down quickly before their the bad guys are doing significant financial harm.
And, you know, and another thing that you can do, which is very common in Europe, but not so common in the United States, is waiters in Europe, when they bring your bill, they bring the reader with them, and the card never leaves your sight. So you can't do that in the United States always. The card sometimes does go back to the waiter station to get scanned, but you can kind of keep an eye on it and see if there's anything strange happening. And like you said, nowadays we do have transaction alerts, so you can keep tabs on whether or not that card is being used.
Yeah, I mean, it's it is frustrating to know that a lot of that those alerts are out there and available with most major banks and or, you know, the Visa, MasterCard, and Amex carriers, and how many people don't take advantage of that. It's just a wasted opportunity to drastically limit the amount of fraud loss that happens when your information is stolen, because it's not a matter of, you know, of if, it's a matter of when. As I know, Adam, and I think all you guys make that point a lot, and it's true. So it's partially about stopping the fraud in the first place whenever you can, but there's going to be times you can't, and then it's about, you know, mitigating it and limiting it as much as possible. So being vigilant.
Which means you have to know as quickly as possible you have a problem, and transaction alerts is one of the ways to do it.
So where was the shopping happening with the stolen credit cards?
So these groups of shoppers, they'd go out, maybe five or six of them with stacks of the counterfeit credit cards and matching counterfeit driver's licenses, and they would fly all over the country. We have them in over 25 states, going into big box stores like Best Buy, for example, or it could be an Apple store, or it could be a store that sells watches and other like smaller jewelry and electronics, camera stores, and Target. So big stores like this, usually where there's a lot of activity, where the people working the registers generally, you know, don't have a great investment in the company itself. Like, they're not the owner or sure. The manager. They're just,
and it was largely consumer electronics, or was it just really anything?
Okay. It was largely consumer electronics, something that they could easily, whatever was selling in big back then. There was iPods, mm-hmm. and iPads, and you know, laptops. There was a lot of laptops, cameras, digital cameras, in anything like that. You'd see some one-offs, but it was mostly the small consumer electronics that they knew they could fence very quickly for 50% to 75% of the face value.
Were they being fenced in small stores, on street corners? Where were they fencing?
The answer is yes. I mean, they were moving them all sorts of ways. They had stores that people didn't really care that much to know the history of where these things came from, and didn't ask questions about, hey, how come we're getting these for, you know, half price or seven, you know, or you know, 25% off when they're brand new. There's just all sorts of unscrupulous folks, store, you know, people that run stores, but also out on the street. I mean, you know, I'm visiting New York this week, and walking around, you just see there's all sorts of different ways that you get approached to buy something.
Especially Times Square. Yeah.
Yeah. Times Square, Chinatown, all over the place. There's just a lot of opportunity to move this merchandise.
These guys were basically using counterfeit credit cards to buy real stuff that a lot of people figure when they buy on the streets, that must be counterfeit, but it's cool. But it's not counterfeit. It's the real deal.
A lot of times, certainly in this particular case that I was talking about, it was certainly the real deal. And purchased on counterfeit credit cards, but you can never forget what's on that counterfeit credit card is stolen, real people's stolen account numbers. And so they might live in New Jersey and the card might be used in Oregon to commit the fraud, and they don't know a crime happened until 30 days later when they get their bill, if they catch it. And they're like, hey, I've never even been to Oregon.
And then that thing that was bought in Portland is being sold on the street of New York to somebody. So now the crime, where's the crime happening? Is the crime happening? I know where some of them are happening, but it sounds like there's several crimes happening. Is the purchase on the street of this item, which was purchased with a counterfeit card that was stolen, a crime? Or, I mean, it just sounds to me like there's just, this is a crime fest.
That's what makes this case so interesting, is that there was all these different criminal activities that all rolled up to a couple of big bosses, but these different groups committing them didn't even know each other. So certainly it's a crime to steal somebody's account number on a skimmer without them knowing. That's a crime in and of itself. The manufacturing and encoding, embossing of counterfeit credit cards is a crime. It's access device fraud.
Even if it happens overseas?
Where there's crimes committed in the United States, the Secret Service has primary jurisdiction in terms of federal law enforcement. We have a lot of overlap with the FBI in these sort of cases, and we work really closely. They are on our cyber fraud task forces. We're on their cyber task forces, but they tend to prioritize cases that involve either state actors or terrorism or crimes, you know, that against infrastructure and things like that. If it's purely financial in nature, generally the Secret Service has primary jurisdiction on this, although we work a lot of these things together. But, you know, that's how these cases, I mean, why these cases are transnational organized crime cases. I mean, they often have, especially when you get into the more cyber-enabled fraud, this fraud we're talking about is a little bit antiquated. Different parts of it are certainly still happening today. But as you get into the cyber-enabled fraud, there's almost always an international element to it.
And oftentimes the international element involves a government perhaps that may not necessarily be friendly to the United States and is looking for an additional revenue stream, perhaps.
That's certainly been the case in some cases that I can think of, for sure.
With these syndicates, I think one thing I'm trying to wrap my head around is how big they are. It sounds like they're obviously enlisting the aid of lots of people with, say, waiters at a restaurant, things like that. But in terms of, like, the core organizing groups that are behind these, is that something like 10 people or 100 people or 1,000?
It was just Adam and me.
So, it's, you know, when you talk about these waiters, there's some people that are sort of managers, and they go out into that community of folks. And that's often folks that are, you know, ethnically or culturally connected. This particular case was in the Asian community, but I've seen it in all sorts of different communities that exist in the United States, white, black, brown. I mean, you know, it certainly runs the gamut. But
so it's equal opportunity.
It absolutely is equal opportunity. And these folks are going to, as many skimmers, the skimming devices, which are relatively cheap that they have, they're going to list as many waiters as they can. So might be 20, 30, 40 different waiters that have been involved.
Is this still going on, by the way, Brian?
Skimming cases are going on. I've heard of them less in restaurants like this and more with fake devices, like fake readers. At gas stations are big. I mean, a couple years ago, there was a huge case all over the country with these gas station skimmers, where they actually kind of put a facade over the front of some of these pumps so that you're not putting it into the stores, you're putting it into theirs.
And driving by that, Brian, would you be able to spot one yourself, having worked on these cases?
No. I mean, we went in and inspected it, and we certainly have. Yeah. When I was young in the Secret Service, we all wore every kind of hat that there was. You would do surveillance, you'd do undercover, or you'd do interviews. We all kind of did everything. As these crimes become more sophisticated, we definitely have our folks more specialized. So we have our folks that go all of our agents now go through basic cyber crime training. But we have a lot of our folks that now go through like really high speed training in that area, and they could certainly spot these things. But driving by on the street, I don't think anybody would be able to tell. I mean, you'd have to go up and examine it. And obviously there's hundreds of thousands of gas stations in the United States.
While this scam was primarily in person and offline, I think that we can say that the same strategies are kind of used today. Phishing, shopping site hacks, buying and selling user data on the dark web. Scammers just get into your life when you're not paying attention. And in those days, people weren't paying as much attention simply because you didn't have the kind of access then that you do now.
Yeah, it was impossible. You couldn't.
It's not like you could go online and monitor your credit card activity or get transaction alerts. It was kind of like you had to wait till the end of the month, or you would find out the really unpleasant way, which is you went to the store, you pull out your credit card, you try to charge something, and you were declined because you were over the limit.
Well, you know, I actually liken it, guys, to the early internet, which, you know, you may recall in the late 90s when you were downloading something, it took forever. Doop, 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 doop.
The dial tone.
And when I got that bill for the gold that I didn't buy that someone bought with my credit card, it came at the end of the month, and it was $5,000 more than my credit card usually was. So I had a heart attack. Nowadays, the heart attack comes much faster because we have fast internet
and instant gratification.
So dying in your shoes because I get a text saying, "Did you just buy an airplane?" So, no, I didn't. But,
well, and this is why our philosophy back started in the 90s and with our initial electronic crimes task forces that have now morphed into our cyber fraud task forces. And the business model is, you know, the Secret Service leads these. They're in all major cities. We have a few international in the United States and a few international ones. But the business model is to bring together all the federal, state, local law enforcement in a particular area, particular region, but also to bring in the private sector, mostly financial sector folks, so all the bank investigators. And then we bring in academia because the academia folks are going to see trends. They're going to be following the technology. The bank folks are going to see, even before all the advances that have been made in the last 20 years, they were still going to see trends. And so, you know, that's how we found out about that skimming, buying counterfeit credit card case that we've been talking about, is that the bank saw some patterns. And since they sit in our cyber fraud task forces and we're all there shoulder to shoulder and we're meeting regularly, they let us know, hey, we're seeing some activity here. And the Amex guy might be sitting next to the Citibank guy and sitting next to the MasterCard guy. And so we start seeing these trends, and then we can be very strategic and focused in our investigations and look for a way in, which might be an arrest of a skimmer that can provide us some information that can go back to the manager, or it might be one of the shoppers got caught out in another state. And he might've got caught 2 weeks ago, but we can go back and take a look at that evidence. And that's what we did. It was a number of different police reports you looked at and informants that were developed, and we sort in information from the banks, and we start to piece it all together and to start identifying the people that are running it, and then, you know, target them through different types of investigation.
So you did eventually get the funnel down to the prime movers of this scam. And how many were there at the end? Like when you finally got to the bottom of it, you did crack this case. Yeah.
Yeah. The agents that work in this case did a great job. This case got so big, we ended up having three case agents, which is unusual for us. We had a squad of 22 agents, and there was times when most of us were working this case, but three of them worked it over several months, over a year full time. And we ended up making 11 arrests, and we ended up going up on a Title III wiretap where we were tapping some of the bad guys' phone calls, and we're able to kind of figure out the whole conspiracy. And with surveillance and with investigations and with other evidence gathering through the banks, we were able to figure it out. So 11 folks were indicted in that case and ended up doing some amount of prison time. And we seized a few million dollars, certainly a lot less than was probably stolen, but we still seized a few million dollars in items that were recovered and in cash.
After you busted this ring, was there any kind of like discernible dent made in that form of crime, or was it just more of a whack-a-mole scenario?
It's, I hate to say it, but it's a lot of it was whack-a-mole until some combination of legislative fixes and or the, you know, banks bringing in new security features and new protocols. It's more like the crime just seemed to sort of float around to different groups. You might see a decrease in a certain population, but someone else is there to pick up the slack. It's hard with all the banks being disparate, even though we have as many of them investigators as we can in our task forces, it's still hard to have a really crisp, clear macro view of what's going on. But this scam was, I'm sure there was dozens of scams going on like this at the same time. And you know, we did and do the best we can to strategically take out the biggest actors. You know, we're not, the Secret Service generally is not going to get involved in a single case of somebody having their identity stolen or somebody's credit card, they're being fraud on somebody's credit card. We're looking for trends and patterns so we can focus on these large groups, which again are often, you know, transnational in nature, and focus where we're going to get, you know, the biggest amount of you know, prosecution and seizures and arrests. We seize a lot of money that a lot of that's able to go back to the victims, and sentences. So we really look for the biggest bang for our buck because we're a small agency. Secret Service has less than 4,000 agents throughout the whole world. And so we really look to use our cyber fraud task forces as force multipliers to work with state and local and city law enforcement and our federal partners and the private sector to be as strategic as possible so we can make the biggest impact in the community to reduce these sort of frauds.
A situation like this versus today is this was obviously very labor intense for the criminals. I mean, they needed a lot of guys. Whereas today with cyber, you don't need a lot of guys, but you can cover a lot more ground, which makes cyber even more dangerous. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
So before we end, maybe skimmers aren't as common as they were in the 2000s, but what can people look for in order to just better protect their stuff in today's world?
Keep their eye on their cards when you can, and to regularly check their accounts online, and certainly make sure they're signed up for the transaction fraud alerts that all the banks provide now. But all, on top of that, just pay attention to what's going on in their accounts. And we all use our card someplace where afterwards we get that little itch in the back of our neck. We're like, that was a little sketchy. So especially in those occasions, to make a point of going on line and checking regularly so you can be right on it. I don't know anybody whose card hasn't been used. One of their cards hasn't been used for some sort of fraud. So it's all about stopping when you can, but being able to quickly be aware of it so that you can shut it down and not get in a place where you're having to fix your whole credit and have to jump through all those hoops and all that pain. So just kind of be on it real time as much as possible, I would say.
Well, listen, Brian, this has been awesome. We really appreciate you coming. And I know you're a font of stories. So we definitely want to bring you back because I have no doubt this is but one of many hair-raising fundraising stories that you can tell us. So thanks an awful lot. And we really appreciate you making time to talk with us.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I appreciate the opportunity and I've enjoyed it. I'd be happy to come back on and chat with you guys. I really appreciate what you guys are doing out there in this space to tell these stories, be entertaining, but you know, educate folks about how they can protect themselves, because that's what it all comes down to. Even with all these great security features and all this information and knowledge that's out there, it comes down to paying attention and making a decision to be aware and protect yourself. And clearly that's what you guys are all about. So happy to talk with you.
Thanks, man.
So as we say, until we skim again.
Oh, man.
Knew we had to end on a dad joke.
Hey, Adam.
Bo.
Travis.
Yes.
I hate when you do that.
Yeah, I know. You're like a butler. It's my pleasure.
All right, both of you. I mean, I had transaction alerts for, you know, as my card in this weird game of cyber fraud and counterfeit credit cards. But there are other things that you can do to protect yourself. And Adam, I know we mentioned it in the show, but you're the one who taught me that you need to look at your accounts every day.
I mean,
do you actually do it?
Every day. Actually, I get accused by my wife of looking at them every hour.
So in other words, like, you really will know within minutes or hours that you've been hacked.
Pretty much.
Travis, do you have anything else that people can do? Like, it's scary to think that you could get... I always thought you could see a skimmer, but it doesn't sound like you can always.
Yeah, they're really low profile, especially the ones that they can put on gas pumps and ATMs. They are just tiny. They fit right over the slot. So yeah, you'd have to be looking really hard to spot one.
Yeah, but one thing for sure, don't use debit cards.
Why though?
Because with debit cards, it's your money. With credit cards, it's their money.
Oh, but they have protections now, or they don't? Not as robust?
They have protections, but they do reserve the right, a lot of financial institutions, to investigate to make sure that it really was a fraud, as opposed to you just had buyer's remorse. So, and it's you have to be careful also, because they'll block your account for a certain amount of money until they finish their investigation. With credit cards, it's a little bit more free-flowing. You report it, they freeze it, they do all kinds of different things that is just, I think, more protective of consumers.
Yeah. Well, I had that money that I had charged to my card for the gold back in the day, that was on my card for 2 months, as I recall. It was frozen on my card for 2 months.
And by the way, Travis and I want to thank you, because that, in part, has helped fund What the Hack with Adam Levin.
Oh, I know that's how you got your teeth. If you can't see Adam, but all of his teeth are gold, all of them.
My grill. Yeah.
Where'd you put your gold, Travis?
Wouldn't you like to know?
So on that note, thanks a lot for listening. And by the way, if you want to give us some real gold, like 5-star gold,
rate and review.
Please write a review. And thank you for listening to What the Hack with Adam, Bo, Travis, Brian, and the rest of humanity.
What the Hack with Adam Levin is a production of Loud Tree Media.
It's produced by Andrew Stephen, the man with two first names.
You can find us online at loudtreemedia.com and on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Adam K. Levin.